Checking in with the State Senator John Keenan of Quincy from the Norfolk Plymouth District for an update on what's happening legislatively and here in the district. Hey, John, good to see you again.
How are you? Great to see you.
Appreciate the opportunity. Unfortunately, still virtual, but thankfully we have this option to talk at least.
Yes, it's a great opportunity, so I thank you for it. Thank you.
And the legislature, as I understand too, is still virtual, correct?
It is. We have been in and out of the building periodically. I think it was about a week or two ago that I covered a session, but the sessions are mostly being done virtually when they're formal sessions, and informally they're just being done in the normal course as well.
Yeah. Any indication from Senate President as to when some in-person meetings might be held?
No, as I say, there are occasionally members that will be in there distancing, very strict about that. As to when the State House will be open to even employees and to the public, it's really unknown now. I would have thought it would be sooner rather than later, but the numbers of cases are spiking again. And so we have quickly embraced the technology and are doing things virtually. So I assume we're going to continue on that path for the immediate future anyway.
Yeah. Speaking of spiking numbers, how do you feel about, the latest phase two opening and some of the easing of those restrictions?
It's... I have faith that Massachusetts has done things pretty wisely, and that's because we've got some of the best and brightest minds here in the medical community, in the scientific community, and government is listening to them. But we're seeing the same uptick in cases as other states are, and in Europe, they're really concerned about what's next. I know in my district, three towns overnight went into the red zones, which means they're at risk, and they may have to change a lot of what happens in the town. Should that continue for 3 weeks. So Abington, Rockland, and Holbrook have all been elevated in terms of the number of cases and their risk level. So it is concerning, and particularly so with the flu coming, and so the seasonal flu in combination with the pandemic, we've got to make sure that our hospitals are ready to handle the both of those at once. And we do have some hospitals in Massachusetts that are already in the surge situations, meaning they've changed their normal operations to accommodate the demand for inpatient care from beginnings of the seasonal flu and for those that are suffering with COVID-19.
Do you know the field hospitals that were set up over the summertime, are those still a viable option if needed?
Yeah, one thing that the Commonwealth has done is we've learned a lot from what we went through back in the spring. So the ability to put those field hospitals back in place quickly is there. I think the hope is that we won't have to get to that if people wear the mask, safely distance, and avoid crowds, that we will be able to handle both the seasonal flu and COVID-19 cases. But the trend is concerning. I wouldn't say it's alarming right now, but it's concerning. And when that does happen and the state comes out and says, oh, you've been elevated, generally you then see a bit of a drop afterwards, because people do get concerned, and while they may have been complacent, it reinforces, okay, we're not out of this. I've got to go back to being more careful.
Yeah. Do you think a statewide mask mandate is in order at this point?
I don't think so. I think the purpose of tracking the communities and giving notice as to when communities are facing rising levels is designed to encourage people to go back to wearing masks. And so as long as they keep doing that, and as long as the compliance is there, which I think it is, then that I think works better than a mandate. Right now, the mandate is so politically charged that if there were to be a mandate, it would really, really have to be absolutely required, because the pushback to that would actually, I think, result in steps backwards in terms of us handling the pandemic.
Yeah. In terms of the public schools, John, how do you think that they've been handling the situation in your district specifically?
So far, so good. They're adapting well. I've been in touch with the superintendents and mayors and school committee members. They're just concerned. They're worried that as much as they believe there is a good quality of education being provided and that students are engaged, it's not the same. They're anxious to get back in the classroom, but they are really concerned about their ability to do that safely. And so there's that balanced approach of hybrid and and different communities are doing it differently, but so far so good, and we're hopeful that progress will continue to be made, and that ultimately students will get back into classroom in some form, whether it's full-time or on a rotational basis.
Yeah, we talk a little bit about the economic impacts. We just saw earlier this week, the governor put forth a budget proposal and starting to look at tapping into the rainy day fund too.
Yes. So they're talking about a $1.35 billion draw from the rainy day fund. There's a couple things at play. We have a lot of capital projects that are out there. And one of the ways that you kind of come out of a situation like this, an economic situation like this, is to continue to invest in your capital projects. And to do that, it's very important that we take advantage of our bond rating and current interest rates. And the bond rating agencies are sending the message that a draw from your rainy day account is responsible. However, you have to match that with responsible spending. Otherwise, you may have a negative impact on your bond rating, and that then costs more to borrow. And to borrow, when it costs more to borrow, you're less inclined to do some of the projects that are needed that also serve to bring us out of this. So it's a responsible proposal of $1.35 billion. It's matched with some federal funds that are in place now that can be used to help us with the current year budget. And also it reflects a commitment to essentially level fund many of our budget line items. Some will see a little bit of a drop, some will see an increase. For instance, in Mass Health, there's gonna be some increased spending. We wanna make sure that there's appropriate spending in our behavioral health lines because people are really struggling. We know that we're gonna have to address housing through some additional funding, with some additional funding. So all of that together, this is the governor's proposal. The House and Senate will proceed with theirs. I met with the chair of the Senate Ways and Means yesterday, expressed what my concerns were. We talked about the general budget process. We're optimistic that we will get through this with too much damage done to our those that rely on the state budget, but there is some concern about the following fiscal year, FY22, which normally would be in the planning stages for that right now. But we're still working on getting an FY21 budget in place 5 months into the fiscal year.
Right. Any indication right now as to what the revenue loss will be for 2021?
There's a pretty wide range of that. There was a consensus revenue hearing, I think it was last week. And so Ways and Means Committees and most of the Senate and the House were involved in the meeting as well. We had people from Mass Taxpayers Foundation, Beacon Hill Institute, our Department of Revenue, Federal Reserve Bank. And there's a pretty wide range as to what that projected revenue loss will be over what was anticipated. People seem to be getting comfortable with the number of about $3.5 billion, which is pretty substantial. But again, draw from the rainy day account, some federal money, tight budgeting. We hope we'll get through it. But the middle estimate seems to be about $3.5 billion.
Okay, and the total state budget is about how much?
Well, $43 billion. The governor's most recent proposal, I think, is $45.5 billion, which is interesting because it's more than what he submitted back in January. Hmm. But it does reflect the need to meet some of the demands associated with the pandemic. And it does reflect the ability to use some federal funds. And so we're hopeful that will, with the Senate and House and ultimately the governor, come to agreement on, we'll meet all the demands. And those demands are growing, and they're very worrisome.
What are some of the capital projects in your district that might be funded through this budget?
Well, not necessarily through this budget, through the capital plan. One of the ones that we have on the books that's going through the early planning stages is a new Norfolk County Superior Courthouse.
Oh, right. Yeah.
When I was chair of the Senate Bonding Committee, we worked on that. That project is now number one on the capital plan. And there's been some communication with the city to go through the early stages of kind of doing what they call the programming. How many square feet do we need? How many courtrooms do we need? What do we need for lockup? So that's one of the big ones. Obviously, our school funding are capital projects. Most of that funding comes through the Mass School Building Authority. But we're looking at some projects in Quincy for schools, Braintree for schools. Rockland is looking at another school, an elementary school. We've been involved with some land transfers to accommodate them for a new school. And then the MBTA, obviously there's a lot of capital spending relevant to the MBTA. So a whole lot of different things out there. And Seawalls is another one that we've worked hard to get some state funding to match some federal and to match some city funding. And so all of those are capital projects which are needed and good for the economy.
Yeah, the tea. I was under the impression the tea has its own separate budget. Is that also part of the total state budget?
They do have a separate budget, and we fund a significant portion of their budget with state revenues. And they are obviously experiencing financial difficulties. They are struggling to get through the current fiscal year. They're projecting a pretty significant operating deficit of about $400 million starting in FY22. So to address that, they're looking at all kinds of options. And one of the options, obviously, is level of service. So they're looking at level of service in all their budget on their bus lines, ferries, Red Line, other subway lines, and also commuter rail. So we may see, for instance, in Quincy, a reduction in how frequently the trains arrive. Right now, the headway, they call it, you know, they want to get down to 4 minutes, but it's somewhere about six. Because of demand, it could, and budget issues, it could be a 10-minute headway. Mm. It means the trains could be a little bit more crowded than what they are now, but we'll have to see. And also, we're experiencing some delays in getting the new Red Line cars in service, as well as the Orange Line cars. There have been some issues associated with the plant out in Springfield, getting materials for those projects and getting those up. Generally, they've been pushed back about a year. So that affects level of service as well. So the MBTA, because of revenue loss, is really in a tough situation right now.
Yeah. Do you think that they should maybe look at cutting some capital projects first, you know, rather than cutting service?
Yeah, they're separately budgeted, even though, you know, within their regular budget, obviously there is a line item to pay for the expense of their capital projects and the bonds that are out there. But, you know, most economists would say you look at the interest rates right now, they are so favorable. The ability to do work because service requirements and service demands are down. Mm-hmm. The combination of low borrowing, available money, and less impact on commuters makes this a very good time to be doing some of the capital projects. Now, we're not going to be able to, do some of the things, for instance, as quickly as we'd like with rail out to Springfield and to Western Massachusetts.
Right.
The South Coast Rail project is proceeding, but that I anticipate will be somewhat delayed. So the focus is on what can we do with the low interest rates, the available capital, do it quickly, and bring our state of good repair to the level where, you know, the T is operating as best as it can, and then we look at the bigger projects.
Yeah, I know the argument always is, you know, these projects also employ people, and that in turn, you know, helps the economy. So it really is a fine line, a fine balancing act that they're walking. Yeah.
Yes.
No, Can we talk a little? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. That I was just saying. I agree. Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, speaking of people working and having trouble meeting demands, can we talk a little bit about the eviction moratorium? That's set to expire actually on Saturday, I think it is, or sometime this weekend, and the proposal to extend that.
So the eviction moratorium is set to expire October 17th.
Okay.
And that has been in place for several months now, and the governor has chosen not to extend it. That's at the state level. At the federal level, there is a moratorium that's in place put there by the CDC. That goes through the end of the calendar year. It's not as comprehensive of a moratorium as the state plan that's in place until the 17th. So the governor is faced with the issue, and the legislature may address this on its own, but what to do after the 17th. The governor's response has been to dedicate, I think, about $161 million to its programming that will help tenants and landlords. That if a tenant is in arrears, they will be able to apply for these funds, and then with proper documentation from the tenant and the landlord, have that funding go directly to the landlord. And there has been a cap to date of about $4,000 per tenant and landlord on those funds. This has gone on much longer than anybody expected. So one of the proposals is to increase that cap so that the landlord on behalf of a tenant could receive up to $10,000. A payment for amount in arrears, plus a monthly payment until they reach $10,000. And in exchange for that, the landlord does not proceed with any sort of eviction. And if somebody's $8,000 in arrears and the landlord only gets 2 months worth of rent to reach the $10,000, and the landlord accepts that, the landlord agrees not to evict over the course of the next 6 months or until June if there are children involved. That's kind of the rough plan now. That's subject to change, but that's been the response to ending the moratorium. There is legislation that would extend the moratorium, and landlords are very concerned about that because they have utility obligations, property tax obligations, and mortgage obligations. And if there's no forbearance on mortgages, they fear that they will face eviction and or rather foreclosure on their properties.
Right.
So I don't know whether the legislature will take any action. There's been some discussion informally about it. My contribution has been to find the right balance, to keep tenants in their units and to keep homeowners in their homes and to keep landlords, you know, in a position where they can keep the properties and keep the tenants in it. I've suggested that as we go forward, one of the things that may be helpful to landlords is for those eviction cases that had started before the pandemic and the state of emergency, that those be allowed through the courtroom doors, so to speak, into the mediation process. That will give the landlord some relief. It will even help some of the tenants kind of get some certainty as to where they are. And my guess is that the courts, which are now hiring retired judges to handle this expected number of cases, will be a little bit more forgiving in the process given the pandemic. And so maybe we can find that middle ground of protecting tenancies and helping landlords keep their properties as well.
Yeah,
it's complicated.
It is complicated. If the landlord does not want to kind of opt into that program, I mean, can they, you know, stay out of it and proceed with the evictions?
They can proceed, but then the tenant would have the option of trying to participate. The landlord has not had the option to this point. It's always been up to the tenant. And some landlords are saying, I know there are tenants out there that are struggling, that have lost full employment or partial employment, that can't pay, but they're just kind of letting the situation stay idle. They're not trying to address it. And so they're trying to encourage those tenants to avail themselves of these programs.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea would be to allow a landlord to initiate that process.
Okay.
Where a tenant may be hesitant and then get them together and try to work it out. You know, we just got today the latest unemployment figures, which give some indication of how real this may be. And in Massachusetts, new claims are at about 40,000 this week, which are up over 10,000 from the prior week.
Wow.
So the number of unemployed isn't going down. New claims are up. They're up significantly, and that mirrors what's happened nationally. Nationally, I think there was about 900,000 new claims for unemployment in the past week. So it is still a very difficult situation. And with that many people unemployed, it certainly impacts evictions and foreclosures when it comes to housing.
Yeah. Is that fund? Is that solvent, the unemployment fund?
No, the unemployment fund is facing some real challenges. And business owners, it's one of those unexpected, one of those costs that most people don't think of that business owners have to pay on behalf of the employees. And we have, over the last few years, essentially frozen the rate of contribution by business owners. And the goal is to do that again, but it's one of those costs that is quite significant. We extended unemployment benefits to people who participate in the economy, gig workers, contract workers, who, because they're independent contractors, don't pay unemployment insurance. But many of them lost their contracts, lost their jobs. So unemployment benefits were extended to them. And so we have to figure out a way to balance that, to replenish the unemployment compensation trust fund, and without further hurting businesses, because businesses, particularly those in the service economy, are really struggling right now.
Yeah, I know, especially with the winter months coming, a lot of restaurants are very concerned. Some have decided to close or just not open. I think I've heard figures something like 20% statewide, will not reopen after this.
Right. Yeah, that's the estimation. I think 20 to 25% of restaurants may not open. And that's a lot of employees.
Yeah. What would you be willing to look at in terms of state budget cuts, John, if it ever came to that? You know, how do you prioritize that?
It's so difficult. I guess, you know, what we have committed to so far, and I think this is probably first and foremost, is that we have committed to local aid at level funding to last year.
Okay.
It's a cut over what they were anticipating for the current fiscal year, but it's level funded. In some cases, there's been an inflationary adjustment for the community, but essentially level funded for a state aid to municipalities. And big chunk of that is Chapter 70, which is school funding. And we had hoped to fund this year, and the governor had committed to it, and the House and Senate were on their way to funding it, the Student Opportunity Act, which was landmark legislation that would have allocated more resources to communities that had a greater need for them in terms of education. All we've been able to do is commit to level funding. So that's a pretty sizable commitment when it comes to Chapter 70, which is our school funding. We've also committed to level funding for our unrestricted general government aid. The combination of those funds fund our schools, police, fire, veterans, senior citizens, libraries. So we've looked to level fund those. That's been our first priority. For me, the second priority, and this is beyond the district concerns that I have, is to make sure that our behavioral health needs are being met. Our medical health needs generally through MassHealth and federal funding, those generally work out okay. Behavioral health, mental health, and substance use often gets lost in that mix. And we are seeing a significant demand or need, I guess I'll say need right now, for those services. The demand is different than the need, which is interesting. We've talked to our providers, and they are saying that they do have available beds, both mental health and substance use, but there's a real hesitancy out in the communities for people to go and get treatment because of fear of contracting the virus and being in a closed place. So we have a lot of people struggling at home with mental health and substance use issues, and struggling on the streets with mental health and substance use issues. It was interesting, I was down in a neighborhood of Boston about a couple months ago. I like to go out and walk through neighborhoods and talk with people. And this is the Melnea Cass Mass Ave area, which some people refer to as Methadone Mile. So I spent 2 or 3 hours down there just talking to people. And it's a really, really dire situation. People who would ordinarily be on their way to treatment just aren't going there. And then you did have some of them who have housing who received some additional funds from the federal government. And that was an incentive for them as well not to go in and get the treatment that they need. So there's a need, but the demand isn't quite where the need is, and the providers are fearful that they'll see budget cuts, and when that demand increases, they're not gonna be able to meet it. And that's inevitable. That's gonna happen in the next couple months as we get into the winter months. So we're gonna make sure that we have proper funding in place for that.
Yeah, it's been called, I guess, the hidden pandemic as a result of all this, as folks, you know, struggling quietly and not reaching out for assistance. It's financially, it's going to take a toll in years to come, I'm sure.
Yes, and we see it. The other thing that we are focused on the budget is housing, as we talked about just a short while ago, and then ways to generate jobs within the economy, and for those that don't have jobs, to make sure that we have resources for out there relative to food security. We talked with Beth Ann Stroll from QCAP about make sure we have funding in place for childcare needs so people can go to work, who are working, that we have funding in place for those who are unemployed or underemployed now so that they can provide heat in their homes. And we expect if you are full-time working and now you're half-time, but you're doing it remotely, you're gonna be in your home more hours a day. And there'll be a greater demand, we think, for heating assistance, whether it's oil or gas, whatever the case may be. So all of those are out there, and it's quite a juggling act, quite a puzzle that we have to solve.
Yeah, as you're well aware, right here in Quincy, Father Bill's is looking to relocate to a new facility. I spoke with John Yaswinski, and they're hoping to launch a campaign to raise about $20 million. Is there help at the state level for them?
Yes, we provide state assistance to Father Bill's. They are a great organization. The work that they do with the money that we give them, and it's never enough money that the state can give because the demand is so great. They really do some phenomenal work. And we've been in regular contact with John as they are planning their new location and then juggling, coordinating the timing of all that with the city and the city's development of a construction of a public safety building. And so we work to get the resources, as many resources as we can, to Father Bill's Mainspring. And it's they're seeing the need too, and it's just need everywhere out there.
I'm
the optimist.
Well, I know you have encouraged folks who are doing well during this time, and there are folks who are doing okay, to consider folks that aren't, basically.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk, for instance, about whether we would have to do anything relative to taxes at the state level. We don't think we're going to have to.
Okay.
In the immediate future. We'll see how the economy rebounds and how all that goes. But as we look at the need for additional revenue at the state level, you know, I think we should look and find out who's done really well in this economy. And there are some people who have done very well in this economy, where other than some social isolation issues, they haven't seen any financial harm. In fact, some people have done, as I say, economically very well. If we can find a way to get to them, and if need be, to tax, you know, those folks, and find a way to do that so that the people that are working up, waking up, trying to keep food on the table, a roof over their heads while working one or two or three part-time jobs, maybe have lost one of those. There's not much revenue to be gained from that, and that would have a significant impact on the economy. But there are some ways to, relative to capital gains, offshore business taxes, things of that nature that we could be rather surgical on. And those who have done the best and who have done well would be asked in that manner to contribute more.
Whatever happened to the millionaires tax? Is that something that's still in the wings?
It's still in the wings. It has to go through one more step at the legislature before it goes on the ballot in 2022, I think it is.
Okay.
My guess is it will go through the legislature and then get to the ballot. And that would provide between $1 billion and $2 billion more per year. And it would tax income over $1 million a year. Income up to $1 million would be taxed just as it always is. So if somebody who's made $999,999 to be taxed just the way they always have been. Anything that they make over the million would then be subject to an additional tax, just the amount over $1 million. But there are a lot of people, we don't seem to know them, but there are a lot of people who make that kind of money. And this would be a way to use that those fundings to help with education in particular. And then also some other capital needs, transportation in addition to education.
Sure. Speaking of ballot questions, John, how do you feel on the two that are coming up on November 3rd?
I think I'm about as confused as everybody else. and I've read them. And then you see the commercials, particularly for question one, it has to do with the data from automobiles. I don't know. I'm going to have to read that one again. We did pass, you know, in the Commonwealth, there's a law that allows or requires a transmission of information for diagnostics on automobiles. That's on the books. It takes it to a different level. And then on the ranked choice voting, I literally go back and forth every day. One day, you know, I read something on it. I say, oh, that makes sense. Maybe we should do ranked choice. And then the next day I'll read something else and say, oh, I hadn't thought about that. And the article that I just read hadn't covered that. I think ideally it would be good to, if you have four or five candidates in a race, to have a primary election. And if none of the candidates get 50%, to have a runoff of the top two, perhaps. Mm. That takes time and it takes additional funding. And ranked choice voters, supporters would tell you, this is a way to kind of accomplish that without having to have another election. But in the simplest terms, I agree with that. But then there's this, you know, when you get into a lot of math and allocation of votes, the further down you go. And so I just don't know.
Yeah.
I will continue to read on it and make up my mind as I go in. And I'm not trying to dodge a question. I legitimately just don't know how comfortable I am in terms of an opinion on either one.
Speaking of voting, how do you think the state is handling the upcoming election in terms of all the different voting methods that are open to people now?
I think the state is doing well, and I think we're doing probably better than a lot of other places across the country. I can speak for my district, the clerks in my district are top-notch. They just do an incredible job. They are professional, committed, nonpartisan. They're just committed to good, free, fair elections where every vote truly is counted. So we're very, very lucky, and I have the utmost confidence in their ability to run this election and run it well. The early voting by mail went well in the primary, and what people don't know is that the election before that, Quincy was actually kind of a test site for counting ballots in advance of Election Day, not revealing results, not even being aware of results, but processing them, I guess.
Right.
And as a result of that experience, they were ready and did a great job with the preliminary election back in September. So I think we've done a good job. And I was down in Braintree today at the Braintree Elder Services, and a woman said, oh, I already voted. She goes, I know there's a lot of back and forth about mail-in voting, she said, but I thought it was great. She said, this is today, she said, this is the first time I have been out. And she said, as you can see, she said, I'm keeping distance from everybody. I didn't want to go into a polling place or stand in a line. And she said, physically, I can't. She says, I just thought mail-in voting was the greatest thing. So between mail-in voting, early voting, which starts this Saturday, mm-hmm. and then regular election day voting, I think we've got all the bases covered. And I think we will do well here in Massachusetts. I fear that that's not going to be the case across the country. You know, when you see people that there's one voting place, one location within a county of a few hundred thousand people, I mean, I don't understand that. And in this day and age, in this country, I just don't understand it. When people are allowed to put out their own, basically, ballot collection boxes, not official municipal, county, or state boxes, it is mind-boggling to me. And I never thought in my life, being a student of government since I was a kid, that I would ever see the day where I worried about the integrity of elections. But I matched that comment with my observation and belief that the vast, vast, vast majority of people will do the right thing, and that we will get results that are reflective of the will of the voters.
Anything else we should add today, do you think, John?
No, I think we covered a lot. I know I talk a lot, so I appreciate your patience.
Not at all. It's a good conversation. It's timely, and it's relevant to a lot of people.
And I would just urge people to trust the election system here in Massachusetts. We've got great people working on it. Please vote. This is a very important election, regardless of whether you're Democrat, Republican, whatever the case may be, whoever your choice may be, just please vote. And I think it's important for our local community, for our Commonwealth, for our country. But I think it's just as important that we send the message to the entire world that while we've had some difficulties here in America, we are still a strong democracy, and that, you know, we stand for every vote counting. And I'm optimistic that when all is said and done, that will be shown.
All right. Folks would like to reach out to you. What are some good ways for them to do that?
Best way is, there's two ways, three ways. 617-722-1494 is the office number. And Doreen usually picks up the phone, and we're very fortunate. Doreen, Abby Morgan, and Andrea, my staff, our team has just done a great job during this pandemic, and I want to thank them. And folks should feel comfortable calling with anything they need. So they can call, or they can send an email to john.keenan@masenate.gov. Or if they just want to go, if they're looking for general updates on COVID or anything else, senatorjohnkeenan.com is the website, and they can also contact us through that. So telephone, email, and website. And then if you see me out and about, please let me know. It's just unfortunate that we're not out and about as much as we normally are.
Sure. Well, appreciate your time, John. Great to talk to you.
Great. Thank you. Joe, be well.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.